this is Yom Yeshua, and today we're having two organizations that are meeting. We're meeting Medical Research Council, which is here in front of us, and fortunately they are accompanied by the Department of Health. And later on at about 11, we'll be meeting the National Health Laboratory Services. We're hoping that we'll be able to start at 11, but it might delay a little bit since we started late. Medical Research Council is here with the president and the chair of the board. They're going to be giving us their strategy for the year and their plans as to what they're going to do. And obviously, as the people are doing oversight, we're going to be looking at what has happened in the past year, so that whatever money that they're going to be given for this year, we'll see whether is it relevant, is it necessary to give them the money for the work that they've done. But I must say, we are working as Parliament. Parliament is one of the three legs of government. And this is an area that, unfortunately, we seem not to have done a proper oversight as the portfolio committee. What I mean by that is that for you to be able to do a proper oversight, you need to have some information. But what we have noticed in the years is that most of the work that is supposed to be done by Medical Research Council and probably passed on to us has not been happening that well, so that we could do a proper oversight as to what we're informed as to what is going on. Because this is one of the most important legs of government, where the policies and laws are done. And as you know, that when we came in after 1994, the aim was to transform government. Now one wonders whether in the Department of Health have we managed to transform. There are good things that have happened. One of them is to get information to know that the life expectancy has improved. I think that is very important. And the second one, which makes everybody happy, is that it seems as if most of the people are getting antiretrovirals now. And in fact, that has got a very big impact as far as prevention of HIV and AIDS. Because once people are on treatment and the viral load goes to zero, it's not easy to infect other people, even if people behave in an abnormal way. But as I say, I think the slant for MRC, which I don't blame them, probably I'm blaming us as the portfolio committee, have been more to report to the department of some of the things. Well, policies are made by the department, even some of the laws are started there, but there's a lot of work that is supposed to be done by the portfolio committee in overseeing whether the money that we're giving is actually going to where it's supposed to go. And I think probably from now onwards, much as you're going to give us a strategic plan, but I think it must appear how you're going to be helping the political bodies, the parliament, to be able to have informed information so that when they make laws, when they accept policies from the department, they are well informed as to those things are going to be able to transform the country. I'm mentioning this looking at some of the things that is very topical, which is the abuse of the vulnerable people, the females and the children. There's no doubt about it that there's a lot of people who are causing crime in South Africa. Not that we were worse off than some other places, but it's something that is happening in a way that you would want it to be better than what it is. And when you look at it, you find that most of these people are in jail. But though they are in jail, you wonder how many of them have got psychiatric or psychosis or psychopathic tendencies. that could be handled after they serve their sentences or while they're in jail. You wonder how many of them is and the jails are full. There's always been complaints that the jails are full. Are we really helping in making sure that we change? I think this is coming from the fact that most of the people, I think certain things happened in such a way that it was making some of us to be paranoid. We are still paranoid. If somebody tells me something once, I always go back to my past. I don't look at things objectively, but there's that paranoid attitude that thinks that this person, because this one is an African, because this one is a white, is doing it for a particular reason. That paranoid, that if you see an African, you see a Tutsi. If you see a white, you see somebody who wants to oppress you. If you don't look at the idea, you look at the person. Obviously, paranoia at an extreme, it's a psychiatric problem. And you look at the fact that most of our parents have been migrant laborers who would leave their homes and work in the mines. And when they get to the mine, they get married to somebody else. The other family is left without a father. And obviously that's an area where you can get a psychopath, because that person doesn't know how to become a father, because the father is not there. So some of the things, have we looked at those things? Is there research that tells us that, look, we need to concentrate in this area to be able to handle these things? This must not be understood to blaming the past, but it's saying now we are in this situation. How are we trying to make sure that we help South Africa to be a better country? How do we make sure that all of us are forgiving, are human beings? It's not easy for me to take out a gun and kill somebody for 10 rands and have no feelings after that, have no feelings of consequences, what is going to happen to me, or start raping an 83-year-old without remorse, without feeling that there's somebody. Obviously, it means there's a psychiatric problem. There have been claims that some people are keeping 55 guns at home because they are afraid that something is going to happen to them. Even if I can have two guns, I can't use both of them at the same time. But to have 55 is something else. One is not sure whether this is happening, but it shows that there is paranoia, there's psychopathic tendencies. Are we having statistics to show that some of these people need some help? Not that one wants to protect people who are doing wrong things, but if somebody does something wrong, they need to go to jail. They need to... Something needs to be done. But is there something that we can do beyond if we've got statistics that show us that that's what's happening? So all I'm trying to say in a nutshell is, members, if we could request EMRC to help and make sure that they work very closely with the portfolio committee, because there are three legs. It's the cabinet, which I'm sure you are working very well with the cabinet, with the Department of Health. There is the judiciary. Obviously, the judiciary has got its own, but there is this part, which is Parliament, which is making policies. And in fact, that's where the laws to change the country and make it a better country are relying on. And if those people don't have information, probably it's going to be difficult to change the country. So I'm just adding that probably we need to close that space and make sure that we move forward. So with that, I will allow MRC to make their presentation, which we are going to engage on it. Let's welcome the department to department. There have been complaints that MRC is working so hard to make sure that we know what's happening in South Africa, and which you are thanking them for some of the information like the life expectancy and other things. But there's always been a complaint that the finances are not that good. So for them, if you pay peanuts, you get monkeys. You won't get what you wanted. So there's always been that complaint that the money that goes there is not enough. But they will tell us And more than, well, good thing is that on the other side, they do get donations. But what sometimes worries is that if you get, you actually report well to the one who gives you more money. So we would want them to report more to government rather than other people. But if they get more money from somewhere, they'll go and report to that person, and it's got to be unfair for the government. So maybe these are some of the things that we need to talk about. Emma says there's one part that probably we didn't complete last year, which probably you need to help us this year. There was a suggestion that you've got a new, not strategic plan, but human resource plan and restructuring the whole organization, which we made a request that we're going to get a glimpse of it. Not that we're going to change it, but just to get a glimpse of it. And most unfortunately, soon after that, the labor unions were on our toes complaining that that transformation is not assisting them. We met them, they came and they gave us, we've got documents that are complaining that this is not going to help them. And we thought that we were going to set up a meeting, and we requested that if you could show us so that we could engage. But unfortunately, because of busy schedules, we never had that time. But we would like to have a situation where we could have a glimpse and then meet with them, that is the MRC, the labor union, and ourselves as sort of mediators, and see where can we meet and make sure that the organization doesn't collapse, but at the same time, the people that are supposed to be doing the work are doing it properly. With that, I won't go any further. I'm going to leave it at that. But we've just got one member that we've got. The others, as I said, they are coming. We've got Uma Mungobo, who happens to be the whip of the committee. The other members, we think that they're going to join us, but we're not going to wait for them. We're going to continue, because myself and Uma Mungobo were here to continue with the work. So we will allow you to introduce yourself and then get into the business. Maybe before we come to you, President and the Chair of the Board, let's start with the department, so that the department can tell us who is here on behalf of the ministry, and then we come to you. Thank you.
Yeah, good morning, Chairperson and honorable members. My name is Nobayeni Dlasa. I'm the Chief Operating Officer in the National Department of Health.
Morning, Chair. My name is Ian van der Merwe. I'm the CFO at National Department of Health.
Okay, thanks. Oh, then it's the right people. There's a lesson over.
Good morning, Chair. My name is Mr. Shwana. I'm the Acting Chief Director for Public Entities Governance at the Department of Health.
Okay, thank you. I think all of you, yeah, those people that if you can take them face, head down, there'll be money that will be falling. Unlike me, if you take me head down, you'll get penicillin and something else. Okay. Is there somebody else? Okay, let's allow you, President, and I never know who's more important, the chair or the President. But it's up to you, but we need your introduction and then we can go on straight away.
Thank you very much, Chair. It's a great pleasure and honor to be with you again. And I'll start by introducing our team that is accompanying the Chair and myself. So on my left is Professor Lizo Mazwai, who is the chair of the board of the MRC, an eminent academician, ex-dean of the medical school, and a renowned surgeon who has been ably guiding us through the last 2.5 years or so as chair of the MRC board. Next to him on the left is Dr. Trish Hanekom, who is the chair of our Audit and Risk Committee, and although a veterinarian by profession, I have to to say that I marvel at her skill with the numbers rather than the animals these days. And on my right-hand side is our CFO, Mr. Nick Buick. And next to him is the head of HR, our HR executive, Mr. Bulelo Bukwani. Behind me, I've got two of our division heads. Sitting on the left-hand side is Sarah Bock, who is the person who oversees the APP and the strategic planning process, and she also deals with our stakeholder relations. And then next to her is Mr. Philip Duplessis, who is the person who manages our budgeting process. So that's who you have with you here today. It's been a while since we were here. I think it's about 5.5 months or so since we were last here. And I just want to take you up on your offer. You know, the MRC takes its responsibilities to the general public very seriously, and our accountability to Parliament and particularly to this portfolio committee in a very serious manner. And we would welcome the opportunity for a much closer and a much more frequent interaction. We do meet on a regular basis with the Department of Health, obviously. As our line function department is the department we report to, we have their representation on our board, but also I meet with the Deputy Minister of Health on a regular basis. We have monthly meetings and the meetings with the Minister and the DG on a regular basis so that they are aware and kept appraised of our new findings and the overall performance of the organization. And not to belabor the point, but also for my occasional requests for additional funding. So what I would like to do with your indulgence, Chair, and Ngobo, I would like to use the next 20 minutes or so to just go through very briefly just a reminder of the mission of the MRC. And I want to spend a bit of time on the research highlights of 2012, talk about our strategic goals and performance. I'll touch on the revitalization of the MRC and the progress we've made with that. And then I'll go on to financial matters and ask the CFO to talk to the budget before making some concluding remarks. So that's our plan of what we'd like to share with you in the course of this morning. So just by way of a reminder, really just to set the stage, the mission of the MRC is that we are about generating new knowledge for policy and practice to improve the health of the nation. And this concept of generating new knowledge is quite an important one because our business is not about simply rehashing what is known. Our task that is given to us is to develop new ideas, new approaches to diseases, new vaccines, new treatments, understanding how diseases are spread, understanding some of the underlying mechanisms, whether they are social or whether they are biological. So we have to be, in many ways, imaginers. We have to imagine a future, and we have to search for the knowledge that will define that future. And in many ways, the future in medicine is in our hands as much as it's in everybody else's. And ours is the task is to elucidate that future and to shine the light on the new knowledge to illuminate the path. Then our overall purpose in this new knowledge is so that we may impact on the way we treat diseases, the way we control diseases, the way we manage these diseases, and how that might improve the health of the nation. So against that backdrop, I shared with you this little flyer, it's a one-page trifold, that basically provides you with the highlights of 2012. And we've chosen to pick on sort of two major scientific findings that I want to highlight here for the purposes of the committee. But I want to start by saying that for us, probably the biggest highlight of 2012 was of 2012-13 was the fact that the MRC featured in the state president's State of the Nation address. Now, I know that, you know, in the midst of everything else he had to say, our one-line mention probably, you know, only means a lot to all of us here, but for us it's really a major shift in that our work is of that standing and that contribution that is worthy of being part of the State of the Nation address. And I'd like to quote our state president in his comments in the State of the Nation, where he said, "It was with good reason that we were delighted when late last year, studies from the Medical Research Council, the Lancet Medical Journal, and others began reporting a dramatic increase in life expectancy." And in fact, what he was referring to was the article that was published in October 2012, which contains the data from the MRC that showed the changes in life expectancy in South Africa. And that comes out of, in this trifold, I will go through the sort of two big findings that we had. Now, you can imagine an organization like ours, we produce around 400 to 500 articles a year. So we produce a lot of new information and new knowledge. I'm just choosing to highlight two because they've also captured the imagination of people in this country. They have highlighted for us two very important achievements. So the first of those is this report that was produced by the MRC, led by Dr. Debbie Bradshaw, who oversees the MRC's Burden of Disease Unit. In this report, which is it's called the Rapid Surveillance Report on Mortality, it highlights one of South Africa's proudest achievements, in that people are now living about 10% longer than 5 years ago, due largely to the impact of AIDS treatment. Now, you would imagine in a country like ours, just over 50 million people, when you have 5.5 million people who have HIV, and we have a very high case fatality rate in the absence of treatment, we had a situation before the rollout of antiretrovirals that we were steadily losing ground in terms of life expectancy. So in the latter part of the last decade, what we saw is a severe erosion in life expectancy, in infant mortality, and so on, that was largely as a result of the large numbers of deaths due to AIDS. But with the introduction of antiretrovirals and the scale-up of treatment, making treatment now available to a very large proportion of those who qualify for treatment, what we've achieved in this country, and when I say we, I use it in a very royal sense. You know, it is as much that we have the Treatment Action Campaign, we have the Department of Health, we have the NGOs, we have the pharmaceutical companies. All of those have combined to make antiretroviral drugs affordable and available and have been able to put them in the hands of the people who need them. So it's a very much a collective achievement. And this achievement has led to a decrease in the number of deaths in children under five. We've also reported a dramatic decrease in adult deaths, a 40% reduction in premature deaths. And then perhaps the most important finding is the increase in life expectancy by 6 years, an increase over 5 years from 54 years life expectancy to 60 years life expectancy. So what does that mean? Why is that a big deal? Why should we even be interested in a 10% increase in life expectancy? Well, in history, the only way in which you can generally get this kind of dramatic increase in life expectancy is by major social revolution, where you change things very fundamentally. So, for example, the steam engine led to a dramatic change in life expectancy. So the abolishment of slavery led to a huge increase in life expectancy. You need major changes in society we didn't have exactly those kinds of social change, but we had as dramatic an effect from AIDS treatment. And you can look at it slightly differently. You can look at it that we have taken 50 million people, and on average we've given each of them an extra 6 years to live. So we've added about 300 million years of person life to this country to contribute to making our country even greater. So it is a major achievement of our country. Our role as the MRC was merely to document it and to highlight it and to serve as a mirror to all of those who made this possible. The second, which is related to the rollout of antiretroviral treatment, is that we've shown that mother-to-child transmission rates have been reduced to 2.7% in 2011. Now, this particular national survey, a very large one undertaken, costing several tens of millions of rands, is undertaken jointly with the US CDC, who actually fund a large part of this survey. And in the course of doing the survey, what we do is we measure what proportion of children at 6 weeks, and we take a range of 4 to 8 weeks after birth, have become infected from HIV-positive mothers. And if we look back historically, if we look at data from some 10 years ago, and if we look at the mother-to-child transmission rate, we were in the range of 25 to 30% transmission. In other words, one out of four babies born to an HIV-positive mother was becoming infected. When we look at the situation now, in 10 years, we've reduced that 25% to 2.7%. In other words, a tenfold decrease in the proportion of mothers who are leading to their children becoming infected. This is a major achievement. I mean, this cannot be achieved unless you have a major program in place, as our Department of Health has done, in that you've got to get people to come into the service, they've got to be tested, they've got to roll out the antiretrovirals, we've got to monitor them. So there's a whole lot of things that need to be done, a very complex set of health systems changes that were implemented. I have to say that, in my opinion, and I think in almost all our opinions, 2.7% is still 2.7% too many. Our goal is to eliminate mother-to-child transmission, and that is our stated goal. And we are part of the World Health Organization's thrust to move towards the elimination of mother-to-child transmission. However, this is not going to be an easy challenge, because what we're looking at in the 2.7% transmission is largely breastfeeding transmission. And breastfeeding transmission poses several serious challenges in trying to reduce that number to close to zero. But it remains our target, and government has now just changed its policy, as you know, from option A to option B, and we will have elements of B+, that is part and parcel of the rollout of the fixed dose combination of a single drug, and we think that that will make a substantial contribution so that we would see in the next few years a reduction of this 2.7% to our stated goal of elimination. Elimination is defined by WHO as less than 1% transmission rate. So these two highlights I want to leave you with, because the MRC has produced these data on a scientific basis and provided that as an understanding of what we are achieving and demonstrating the value of the investment that has been made by our country and indeed by many donors and international organizations to achieving the rollout of antiretroviral treatment. Let me now go on to our strategic goals. As part of our strategic plan, we have overall four strategic goals, and they are in line with the NSDA, and our goal is really about the using research as a mechanism to impact on health and the quality of life. And we want to do so through innovation, through technology development, and through research. And in addition to the first two strategic goals, we in addition have the other two strategic goals, which is about our place as part of a global initiative. We are not the only ones doing medical research. The entire world is involved. And we have to fit in and try and contribute uniquely to what we need to produce for our country, but at the same time take into account what's happening globally, and then to increase our performance as an organization. In relation to that, I've just picked the, for the purposes of this presentation, I've just highlighted the indicators that we measure quarterly. I've not taken the indicators we measure annually, and they are available in your, in the document. But we haven't completed the annual measurement yet, so we don't have those numbers completed at this point, and they haven't been checked. So I am not presenting those to you right now. I'm just presenting perhaps the four most important indicators anyway. So the first is about the amount of health research that we've undertaken, and we measure that by really what is regarded as the global standard, which is, you know, how many peer-reviewed journal articles are you producing? And we set targets for that, and we had set a target of 328 articles for the course of 2012, and we have, by the end of the third quarter, exceeded that target with a total of 416 articles. Clearly, we need to readjust that target going into the following year. In terms of health research that we support, it's very important to remember that the MRC has, quite importantly, dual function. Not only do we do research, we also fund research. We are supposed to be funding and viewing our funding role as important as our doing role, in that all of the medical schools and the universities undertaking health research depend on the MRC for their research funding. And there we had set a target of trying to support a 30 projects, but thanks, due to some external support and to our ability to reach out a little further, we were able to support 74 projects. The third indicator is about the looking at research results and looking at how best to translate them into policy. And so at the beginning of the year, we set a target of policy briefs. And we set the target of producing about 20 of those in the course of the year. But very early on, we recognized that the policy briefs were not reaching and not achieving the goal that they had set out to do. That it became much more important for us to have one-on-one meetings with the individuals who are to directly influence policy, and that producing these reports was not achieving their goal. They were merely becoming just like the journal article. The idea was to translate the journal article into something more readable. So we are rather looking and will be changing this indicator in the future to one that looks at our direct interactions and impact on policy rather than on policy briefs per se. And then the last is looking at our international research cooperation. We set a target to establish up to 42 agreements. We've exceeded that target. And just very importantly to say, we have just completed and signed an agreement with the U.S. National Institutes of Health, which is the world's largest funder of medical research, to undertake some joint programs where they and us will jointly fund South African science. So I'll move on. I'm not going to touch on the annual indicators. I'm happy to take questions during the question time on those. And to look at overall in terms of our goal of trying to achieve a clean audit for this year, we did achieve a clean audit in 2011. We think at this point we are on track for a clean audit in 2012. I will just say that, you know, this list of indicators is quite long. I've only just provided you with the top end of it. And I'm very pleased to note that we have more green smiling faces than yellow or red ones. In fact, yellow ones are actually not bad. We do have a few red faces, but we have undertaken quite a lot of effort to try and address those. They revolve largely along legal compliance in terms of certain acts that we need to comply with, and especially in those is the MRC Act, which, as you know, is a pre-democracy act that needs to be updated. If I can go on to now the revitalization of the MRC, one of the tasks that we undertook was to look at our organization. Are we getting the best value for money? Are we having the biggest impact? And there were four reports that informed the need for change within the MRC. The one on the extreme left-hand side is the SETI review, that is the review undertaken independently. It's a government-commissioned review. And that review pointed to several shortcomings within the organization. In addition to the SETI review, the Academy of Science in South Africa undertook a big study where they looked at clinical research in South Africa, and they noted South Africa is on a steady decline in terms of clinical research and the need to bring South Africa back on an even keel and to revitalize clinical research within South Africa. In addition, we have the National Health Research Committee, which hosted a summit in 2011. This is their report, which also highlights certain shortcomings in our research. And then finally, the Green Report, which is produced internally by us, which takes into account all of these reports and produces a way forward. And that way forward looks at trying to address three fundamental problems in the organization which have been identified. The first is that we have declining scientific stature of medical research, and all the indicators tell us that even though we are producing as many articles as we did, in reality the whole world is producing many more. It's like running a horse race. Everybody's running. So if you sort of stand still, you get left behind. And so what we have been finding is that our citation rates are now dropping, the impact of our publications is dropping, and it's not just dropping in 1 year, it's a steady decline over many years. What I'm describing to you is not something that occurred overnight. It is something that we have observed over the last decade or so. The second is that the MRC is not fulfilling its custodianship role in medical research in South Africa, in that because medical schools and universities depend on the MRC to fund their medical research and their health research, if we stop providing large sums of money to them, then they basically are not able to do their research. So they close their laboratories, they stop taking students, and that has a huge repercussion for us as a society and indeed for the future of medical research. And what has happened over time is that because it's a fixed budget that the MRC has, the steady internal growth of the intramural part of the organization has meant that there was less and less and less available to give to universities. So that if you look at the situation in 2011-2012, we gave 19% of our budget to universities. Now that is a very small proportion. It used to be, certainly when I was at the MRC just over a decade ago, that we used to give half of the funding to universities and use the other half for intramural research. So that shift has seen basically an erosion of monies available to universities. And what we've seen is an expansion of intramural units. In fact, when I was in the MRC in the 1990s, we only had about 9 intramural research units. We currently, in the MRC, have 27. So this internal growth has meant that we've got some duplication, some expansion. So for example, you know, we have 3 different TB units doing different kinds of research, not really collaborating, and so on. So we've got to address these inefficiencies within the organization. And one of our biggest challenges is if we look at our intramural research units, we spend 90% of our budget on salaries. So what does it mean? It means that if you work for the MRC, we basically don't have money to give you to actually do research, because all the money we have, we basically spend it on employing you. So the 10% of the money that's available for budgets is really to make sure that there's paper in the photocopier and the lights go on when you press the switch. There's really no money to actually buy, you know, other than a bit of reagents and a bit of lab equipment. You really don't have money. So that means that the MRC staff have to look externally for funding to do their research. And you've already highlighted that point. He who pays the piper, you know, I think is a very fundamental issue that we grapple with. But the MRC at the moment is heavily dependent on external funding. And in fact, if we take the intramural research program, the monies we get from external donors is about twice what we get, what we allocate in terms of Department of Health or government funding. So we are really dependent on external sources. And that is a challenge in terms of donor agendas, because it means we can only really do research that donors are willing to fund. So we have these three key problems: declining scientific stature, the need to fulfill our broad custodianship role, and the need for us to be able to really provide money for our intramural research units to do research. So we've implemented a set of activities to fix these problems. And high priority activities have already been initiated. And in order to initiate this process, we went through a very complicated set of negotiations with the three trade unions that operate within our environment. And over the last 6 months, we've engaged with them, and we now have an agreement on the way forward. One of those things in that agreement is that we will now prioritize our in-house research so that we focus on the 10 most common causes of death and disease. We simply can't do everything. We'd like to do everything, but we can't. And if we want to have an impact, we must pick the diseases that are causing the most amount of death and disease. And if we're going to do that, let's do it and do it properly so that we can make an impact on those conditions. We want to increase our extramural funding to universities and to medical schools and to rebuild that base of research in the medical schools. We want to create new funding approaches. What we find is that the MRC's funding mechanisms are not geared up to really do drug development, vaccine development, diagnostic development. They are much more inclined to doing like surveys and doing smaller projects. When you make a commitment to develop a new drug, you have to commit in the long term, and you have to commit large sums of money in a particular pathway to do that. And so we've created this new funding mechanism. And I'm very pleased to tell you, and I'm going to go through it in a bit more detail, in my meetings with the Gates Foundation, they were so impressed with this approach that they've given us $100 million in order to fund our activities in terms of new drug and vaccine development. We also want to increase the efficiency and the effectiveness of our administrative systems. We want to increase the quality of our research and peer review. We want to improve the utilization of our space and our laboratories. You know, for example, we have three different units in the same building on three floors where there's a lot of duplication in laboratory. And so what we're trying to do is try and create cores of different pieces of equipment so that we have the benefit of sharing across the three different units instead of duplicating it. And we want to improve our research support functions, access to medical journals, and so on. So these are the seven activities. We've already started implementing them, and we should pretty much be well on track by the end of this year with our implementation. And part of all of this is that we will be developing a new strategic plan as part of this new vision for the MRC. So why did we end up in this situation? Why are we in this kind of complicated situation where I'm talking to you about declining scientific stature and lack of funding? It's fundamentally because of the financial state of the MRC. If you look at the last 4 years, our funding, our baseline grant, grew only by about 3.5% per annum. As I've pointed out to this committee previously, that basically means in the last 4 years we've gone backwards. If you take inflation rates as running at about 6 to 7%, we've been steadily diminishing the amount of money we have available for medical research. And that's what's created this kind of dire financial situation, in that our MRC budget has effectively been shrinking in the last 4 years. And in fact, we are heading for repeated budget deficits. We had a budget deficit in 2012 of $42 million, which we were fortunately able to deal with because we had a reserve of $42 million. So now that we've wiped out our reserve, we have no buffer left. We have no buffer left to withstand another budget deficit in this coming financial year. And we've approached the Department of Health to look at ways in which we can improve our budget situation. And I want to make the point that the MRC budget and what we get and what we provide to South African science is less than 10% of what the US NIH provides. So if you look at Who's funding South African research? Who's funding medical research in South Africa? Well, it's actually the NIH. They are the biggest funders. Their contribution is over R1 billion a year in funding to South African scientists. And I was just in a meeting with the U.S. health attaché, and he was describing how South Africa is the single biggest recipient of medical research funds outside of the U.S. So we are, without question, a major player as far as U.S. funding is concerned for medical research. I would like to see the South African government being the most important funder of medical research in South Africa, not the U.S. government. So what's our financial state going over the next 3 years and the next MTEF? So these are the numbers. What we've been allocated by Treasury and the Department of Health in terms of our annual baseline is R1 billion and 37 million. We have, in addition, secured additional funding over the next 3 years. And this is thanks mainly to the efforts that have been undertaken together with Treasury. And so Treasury has allocated us an additional $340 million from the Competitiveness Fund. And this is part of our effort to make South African science globally competitive. And we've received in the coming financial year $90 million of that $340 million. We've also received an additional $100 million from Treasury, which will be part of our improved baseline funding. But this $100 million is a very interesting $100 million. It's only available in 2015. So it's not available this year or next year. It's only be available in 2015 when Treasury thinks that money would be available. And that money was provided by Treasury in response to the Gates. When we met with Mr. Bill Gates, his offer of $100 million was contingent on the government matching his funds. And these funds will be used specifically to develop new drugs and vaccines and diagnostics for HIV and TB. And that's what the Gates Foundation has given us. We've also got funding from DST, a grant that comes from DST also for technology development. And then the Department of Health has given us $15 million over the next 3 years, $5 million a year, for this scholars program, this PhD program. And Discovery Health has contributed $10 million and has committed to contributing $10 million a year, so that we have $15 million each year for this PhD program. I have to say that the goal of 1,000 PhDs over the next 10 years is not going to be achieved with $45 million. But at least if we get 100 PhDs out of the $45 million, I'd be pleased. So that's our financial state. I'll now hand over to the CFO. We'll just briefly go through our budget. And there's a lot more detail on the budget in the documentation. What I've provided in the slides is just an overview. Nick?
Yeah. Thank you very much, and good morning, everyone. There are just two slides that I'd like to take you through. As mentioned, the details are in your pack. The first would be the summary of income, and the President has alluded to it, but I've put the details down there for everybody to see. These are obviously excluding VAT. The numbers on the previous slide were including VAT. We need to obviously refund 14% of the monies received from government. And you can see that if I look at the 2013-14 year, which is the second column, the top line is our permanent baseline allocation, which is going up by 8%, so slightly above inflation, so there has been some improvement there, although I think there's still more funds needed to secure our baseline. The second line is the improvement in conditions of service allocation, which is included in the baseline as well, which is $9 million. Then there are other sources of income that we actually generate internally. The first one is interest on funds that we receive. When we receive funds from foreign donors, etc., they're obviously in the bank until such time as they're spent, and we do earn interest on those monies. And then we recover overheads against some of our contracts where we actually provide corporate services for funders. We are enabled to actually recover some of those funds, and that is $26 million for the next financial year. Then we have sundry income. That's mainly as a result of leases. Some of our property and buildings across the country, we do lease out to tenants, and so we do make some money on leasing, which gives us a total amount of $329 million for the new financial year. Then we receive the money for SAVI, which is from the DST. And then, as mentioned, the economic competitive and support package of $78 million. Bear in mind, though, this is not ongoing. It's one-off funding, so after the end of the three-year period, a lot of this may disappear, so one cannot use this money to actually fund ongoing costs. So we've actually used it for project activities and what we call flagship projects. So the total allocation there is $420 million. And then we've received additional funding from the Department of Science and Technology of $29 million, the Gates Foundation, which we mentioned this year, of $30 million, and then additional monies that we receive generally every year from contract funding, and we estimate that of around about $250 million. So the total amount of income which we anticipate for the new financial year is $729 million. That is a 31% increase from the $556 million which we're anticipating this year. And as I say, most of that is coming through from the Gates funding that we're receiving, as well as the competitiveness fund allocation in the new financial year. That will then increase by a further 7% in 2014-15, and then by another 15% to close on R1 billion in the 2015-16 year. That's when we get the additional 100 million rand coming in from National Treasury in the outer year. So that's the funding situation. And if I could just dwell briefly on the cost side, the first column in the next slide is 2012-13. That is our forecast for this current financial year. And you can see that we are forecasting a deficit because of the baseline funding increasing lower than the inflation rate. We've actually budgeted for a deficit in the current financial year, and we anticipate that we will have a deficit of some 42 million rand, which is very much in line with our budget. But that's obviously not sustainable. One cannot continually budget for a deficit. And what we have done in the new financial year is, in the years thereafter, is that we are budgeting for break even. So some of the monies and some of the savings we've managed to achieve as a result of the revitalization process will go to reducing our deficit and ensure that we are financially sound and that our balance sheet is strong. So you can see that in the outer years we have a zero deficit, and the expenditure will actually increase our costs. So from an income perspective, $329 million in 2013-14 will be offset by expenditure of $329 million. The other income, which is the competitiveness fund money and the other monies we receive from foreign donors, will go directly into research. So that will be invested directly into improving research and also some CAPEX. You can see there's $13.6 million in CAPEX. That's mainly to fund some of our laboratory costs, IT, and some of our physical infrastructure. So that, at the end of the day, gives us a zero deficit, which will be repeated in the outer years. So that's essentially a summary of the budget. I'll hand back to the President to conclude. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Nick. So just by way of conclusion, just to make the point that for us, 2012 has been quite an important year in terms of our scientific contributions and the new knowledge we've contributed. And I think for us, a highlight being the mention in the State of Nation Address. We feel we're on track for a clean audit. We're hoping we'll have one. We are in the process of revising the strategic plan, and so there will be a substantially different strategic plan, one that will focus much more on impact and with new strategic goals and targets. And we want to raise the standards to world class. We want to raise the stature of our scientific, of our medical research. And we want to revitalize the overall clinical research environment within the medical schools. In addition, the revitalization of the MRC is well underway. We have increased funding for new drug development, vaccines. As you know, we already have at least two new drugs that we're working on, one for malaria, one for TB. We're working on some diagnostic tests, and there we have a new diagnostic test that we're working on for TB. So we've got major investments that we have to make to see these new drugs and diagnostic tests through to completion. We've undertaken the reorganization of the intramural research to focus on high impact. And we've got new funding for universities. We've doubled the monies available to universities this year, and where we've asked each university to put up their flagship project so that we can provide substantial funding for that, for them to buy new equipment, employ more students and researchers. Our fundraising, We are about 100 million short per year in order to reverse the decrease, the decline in our budget. And so that's our ongoing target, to try and find an additional 100 million each year over and above the funds we've already raised. To this end, we continue our fundraising efforts. We continue badgering the Department of Health and Treasury, and we continue interacting with philanthropy to try and see what potential sources there are to assist us with additional funding. But ultimately, we keep our eye on the prize. We want to continue our efforts to generate new knowledge to improve the health of the nation. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Mr. President. You quoted the other president. I suspect Prof. Mazar probably as a chairperson would give him a chance. But before we do that, let's welcome the other members that have joined us. Honorable Dudley, welcome Honorable Robinson. We've allowed NHLS, because they came early, to come in and sit and listen. But we don't expect them to ask any questions or to vote if they happen to be voting. Members, before Prof. Mazar comes in, I think it's... one thing that is very clear is that in South Africa, we've been going through, if you look at the health indicators, South Africa is not very good. If we're moving in a particular direction, we need to change that direction. And if you live in a world of evidence-based era, we need to have evidence when we are changing direction as to, if we're changing from here, where are we going? And now organizations like MRC become very key. Otherwise, you can't just take your gut feeling and say, let me change, and you don't know where you're moving from to where. Now, it becomes very key. But it is very worrying that MRC, they say themselves, that they've not managed to do certain things. The clinical research, working with universities, with their stakeholders, and getting a lot of funding from somewhere. Slim puts it as extramural. They say it's extramural, Slim. So it, now, I take it that South Africa is unique. You can learn from the left, you can learn from the right, but at the end of the day, what you need to do for South Africa is what is happening in South Africa. You can learn from the West, you can learn from the East, but what you do for South Africa depends on the material conditions in South Africa, and we've got to know the information in South Africa. We are unique in the sense that one of the biggest industries for decades has been the mining industry. And the mining industry has made it certain areas to be economically viable, the others to be less, and that has actually widened the gap between the rich and the poor. And it has affected health, because most of the health indicators that are bad are coming from those areas that have been totally neglected, which are rural areas. And it's unique, it's in South Africa. Well, it might happen in the other countries, but it's one of the areas that is happening. And in fact, we are one of those areas. We've got two rural areas. They are formal, well, economically placed rural areas which are farms. And the rural areas which are led by the traditional leaders, where there's actually nothing. They've been totally neglected. They've been labor reservoirs. And all those things, these are the things that we need to factor. And it needs to be done by South African scientists to help us in doing that. So, but by the look of things, it seems as if they don't seem to have enough to do that. And as a result, if we don't have information, we'll end up using information from somewhere else to try and transform and move. I'm not sure whether you have looked at the National Development Plan and put it together as to where do you think South Africa, would you want us to be in 30 years? Because in health, you've got two areas. You've got one area where you've got to deal with emergencies, where there'll be no drugs in a hospital, where somebody has not got what they wanted in hospital, obviously those have been dealt with as emergencies. But we've got to have a long-term plan as to, in 30 years, where do we want to see South Africa to be as far as health? And National Development Plan talks about that, but I'm not sure whether the MRC, all I'm trying to say here is that Medical Research Council is probably supposed to be the start of everything. And for Parliament, it becomes very important because it's one leg of government where we need to make policies and laws. This is where the laws are made. And if we don't have information, we'll make wrong laws. And in 2 years down the line, we'll want to amend and do this type of thing. But if we've got information, it's evidence-based, and it's going to be good. And it must be South African information. We can compare with other people and learn from them. But the material conditions of South Africa are material conditions of South Africa, and it has got to be done. That brings the point of 45 million. I was very happy we invited when there were some PhDs that were graduating, which we really commend. I must say we are very happy. But as the President is putting it, that it is not enough. We need more, and one would want to have the local doctors, the local professors being the one. I can never talk of New Zealand because I don't know New Zealand that well. I read about New Zealand. I cannot talk about China. I only go to China. I read about China. But I can talk to you about Tsinghua because that's where I was born. That's where I grew up. I don't have to write a script about it, but I can tell you what's happening. And I know exactly what needs to be done there. The only thing that I need is money to make it happen. So if we get local scientists, we are better off than getting scientists from somewhere else to come and tell us. They must come and teach us how to fish, not bring us fish, and it has to be done by us. We are fortunate that we are not like some of the developing countries where they became democratic without having learned people. We are lucky that we've got our own learned people, and we need to use them to our benefit. And the good thing about scientists, which is something that I know probably some of us believe in that notion, that it's not about money. They usually enjoy their work. They usually enjoy staying in laboratory. And I've never had, maybe you can remind me, I've never had scientists doing for a raise of salary. I've never had them. I don't know. Maybe they do, but I've never had them. But neither have I heard somebody saying that a particular scientist has been corrupt because he wanted a tender, and he ended up because he wanted a tender for doing this vaccine, and he did certain things that were going behind. I've never heard of it. I don't know. Maybe that. What I'm trying to say is that for them, it's not the money. It's the love of the work that they are doing, even if it's behind closed doors. For them, that's the work that they would like to do. So why don't we encourage them? I was surprised this morning when I heard that some students don't have grade 12 certificates. And now you ask yourself, if we get somebody who doesn't have a grade 12 certificate and is found a third year, maybe you might find him doing a PhD. Is that child going to be interested in the research? He's going to be interested in all, because that person doesn't have integrity, doesn't have credibility. So these are some of the things. But Prof. Mazwai, before we get questions, I'm not sure if you want to make some comments as the chair of the board.
Yes, thank you very much, Chair. I would make some comments, and in fact, first of all, to just... In your presence, or presence of the portfolio committee, to acknowledge the hard work that's been put in by the president, the board itself, to get us where we are. You will appreciate that in the first encounter, as in our three-year term, we, by the way, are in our last year of tenure now.
And the first year was very, very difficult because we had to sort of stabilize the institution in terms of getting a president, beefing up the executive management, and it took us almost a year to get round to that process. And I think in the last year we were able to make the kind of strides which the president has just reported, because we had to spend quite a lot of time in our own internal processes. Notwithstanding that, a lot of the achievements, in fact, have we've had quite significant national and international importance and impact. Just as a general statement, some of the challenges which, in a very broad sense, would face any organization like the MRC in our country is what I call mobilization. And it's mobilization of ideas in order to generate the new knowledge we've talked about. We also need to mobilize people with appropriate skills, qualifications, in order to fill some of the critical positions and posts in this organization. And also be able to mobilize funds. You have heard and understand the way our funding stands at the moment. While it is a great credit to the fact that we're able to source external funds to these large amounts which have been, there still remains a serious challenge for the reasons that have been given. Not just because he who plays the piper calls the tune, but we're concerned that even the Western economy has got its own fragilities and risks. What happens if there's a change of government in some of these countries? What happens if there's a meltdown and the funds suddenly dry up? So it is extremely important that although we're doing well in terms of this sort of broad external, the need to become more dependent on our own internal resources is very important. Moving forward, looking at that sort of global thing. In terms of the people, that's the funding. In terms of the people, we believe, and when we came in, we understood that we had an aging sort of cadre or repository of scientists in the country, and the age still continues to be a challenge of aging people. By the way, scientists, as you said, maybe do not toy, but they do walk out. And sometimes it's not even for money. It's usually if they can't do what they're expected to do because you don't have equipment or this kind of thing. They just walk. So that retention to training, the retention of the scientists that we have is an important investment for the sort of long-term future in our, not just for the MRC, for the country as a whole. Time is a resource we don't have a control on. And therefore, the sort of priorities, President has already indicated that we've put certain priorities. A lot of the priorities have been sort of reorganizing, or what we've called revitalization of the organization. It has got a lot of implications in the short term, medium, and long term, not just financial, but how the whole organization is going to be structured. And this kind of change or revitalization does bring some instability. Sometimes it might retard growth for a while, because for the last 6 months, I think we've spent most of the time at meetings with the unions and signing up an agreement, which I think was the 1st of March, was a watershed day when we actually signed an agreement to where all the parties have agreed. But we've still got to implement that. Hopefully, by the end of the year, most of the things will be done. We have now almost a full team at the executive management. I'm delighted all attended, and that the board has always supported these changes. There's nothing that has been done without the board's approval, and you appreciate that, because sometimes you get that dysfunction between board and executive, which might have been picked up in early years. We also have a full support and backing of the Department of Health, and we know that because of this sort of constant communication. And as we stand here, we hope at the end of the day, the portfolio committee will also give some form of endorsement to some of these things. We'd like your critique. We'd like to hear your questions and to improve on some of the things which we have been doing. Lastly, as I said, I don't want to take too much time because this is just a comment. Is that really we do have a new challenge? We change things, and by changing them, we create new challenges. And those challenges, you've already alluded to that. Where are we going to be in relationship to the National Development Plan, Vision 2030, the national health insurance in the country, which also has to be incorporated into our research, and we don't have time to put that kind of detail. We actually established something called SHIP, which has thought we're going to set sail, and members might just ask about that a little bit later, which will take some of the things which are not covered in those sort of priorities we had to prioritize, and yet we don't think we've left out anything. We just need resources, and we need time, and we need sustainability in the organization. With those few words, I just want to thank the president and the staff in the offices, executive management, for having supported the board through a very difficult year, and that, in fact, I believe this is a much better presentation than we've had in the past. We can still look back, and you probably ask us, what about this? You said you'd do this. I hope we'll have answers for that. Dr. Hanekom here is the one who always keeps us on the audit and issues. So we hope that if there are some tricky questions, we will refer them to her. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Prof. Mazai. Members, that is the presentation. And I'm sure, though we had already apologized on your behalf, that we're not supposed to have a meeting today. But because it's a committee week, so we're having a meeting, and some people are attending other meetings. But now that you are here, at least you came early, so you had the presentation. So it's for you to ask questions before we conclude. That was the presentation. We leave the department to answer some of the questions. I see Utaini has just joined us. Is Utaini still part of the department, not part of Mangueng Hospital? I think she's part of Mangueng Hospital, but she's part of Limpopo. And Limpopo is still under administration. Oh, okay. Okay. You might not have to answer questions. I think it's Ian and Ian moves with ladies. He doesn't move with males. He always likes two ladies. He always likes ladies. Okay. Members, those are the reports from MRC. It's for you to ask questions, to interrogate what they've told us.
Chair, thank you very much indeed. I do have some questions, but I also have a question to you. You normally say when 11 o'clock comes, it's tea time. Is there no tea time today, and then we've got renewed energy for the questions?
No, what happened, Honourable Robinson, because we knew that some people are attending other meetings, we started with tea. We said we're going to delay tea a little bit, though NHLS, which was supposed to start at 11, is already here. So we won't have a lot of questions for them because we want to go to NHLS. But you can have tea as we move along.
Well, then I'll ask my question first, and then I'll sustain the inner person that hasn't eaten yet today. Thank you. First of all, I want to say thank you for a good presentation. I like your honesty and I like your openness and accepting that there are, or there have been problems, but that we are making progress, and from the president and the professor. So we certainly have challenges, and I think you're aware of them. And as we know, the biggest challenges are the funding. And my concern is that our own government is not giving us enough funding. I'm not going to go into speeches about where money is being wasted and so on. I think people read the newspapers for that. But I just think we need to focus on our nation, our people, where we need help, where we need health, where we need prosperity to take our nation forward. So, yes, I am concerned about the fact that we are losing scientific professional people, not only those who work because they are so frustrated that they do not have the means to do the research that they can do. I know at UCT there was a case of a sophisticated machine. I won't go into details. I think that was acquired through lottery funds. And thank goodness for the lottery sometimes doing something good. But there are no people to drive the machine, to operate it. And we are losing skills, and we are also losing our own citizens, our people, because the research cannot be done. I'm happy to hear that we've got the research programs and at least that we're increasing the number of PhD students, but you know as well as I do that it takes a long time before people have got the experience and the training. You don't just pop them you pop a pill. So we really need to look at the conditions where people are not frustrated, those that we do have, that they can still do the work. I won't go into too much detail, but I do want to know about the NHI. What research projects are being done? The NHI is an enormous project. It is very controversial, exactly because of lack of funding. I think we all share the thought that we would love to have good medical care for every single person in this country. But we have to make sure that it's going to be a model that is sustainable, that is going to work. So I would like to know more details about the ship. Is it going to be able to set sail? Is it a pipe dream? If so, we've got to look at a change in approach. What can we do to make this thing a successful so that we're not pushing people and resources apart, but rather bringing them together between the private sector and between government? I'll leave it at that. Thank you.
Thank you. Honorable Dudley.
Thanks. Yes, thanks for the presentation. It was nice and easy to follow, even with my coming late. I apologize. Just thinking about the unions, I know the chair mentioned because we don't see, it doesn't affect us straight away if scientists down tool. We think they're not downing tools and all's fine, but how much is the whole issue of unions actually impacting on the problems that you have? And is it, do you see the light at the end of the tunnel, or do you see it getting worse? And I don't know, I just think maybe we should look at that issue, because I can imagine why we don't see it. It's completely closed to us. The decrease in spending on consultants, are we right in saying there's a decrease? And how serious is that? Is it a good thing? Is it a bad thing? Are there reasons for it? Is it something that we should be looking at as problematic? And then the policy briefs that are published being below target, what would those reasons be for low performance there? Maternal and child mortality rate. I didn't pick up exactly. I mean, so obviously people are living 10% longer and the HIV transmission's down and whatever, but overall, how is that mortality rate? What do you find? And are you prioritizing that, and is it still the pressure on that there has been for a while? And you mentioned obviously the 10 most common causes of death and disease in South Africa, and we've been seized with the whole violence and rape and all of those issues. Are those things being prioritized? I think that would be mainly it. You did mention SHIP, and we might want to know about that, but I'll leave that to anybody else's questions. Thanks.
Thanks, Honourable Dudley. Again, I'm told that the first heart transplant started in South Africa. The CT scanner was invented in South Africa. the first creepy crawler, that thing that cleans water in a swimming pool, in 1979 started in South Africa. It means we've got brains. We've got brilliant people who can think. But whether we are able to keep them to continue doing that work, it's another question. Honourable one.
Thank you very much, Chairperson, and thanks for the presentation, Slim, and the President, Dr.
Professor Abdul,
and the President. I understood that DST do give you a grant, and DST also has got CSIR, which is doing a lot of nanotechnology towards a treatment of tuberculosis. To what extent have you communicated around that? What on tuberculosis, it seems to be escalating rather than decreasing. Can you enlighten us to that? Why is it so? And because South Africa is said to be almost an epicenter. We thank you and the team on the reduction of HIV and AIDS. When it comes to funding of universities, it seems that quite a big chunk comes from you and the Department of Higher Education, or maybe that was not happening before. Now that we've got the Department of Higher Education, which also should be funding research. Is it doing it, or is just doing just a bit of it, which is really not adequate? I know HSRC is represented in all provinces, which is quite good, I think. You've got a problem of retention of scientists. Is there a thinking of importing scientists as well, so that as they work here, not to learn, but to know about the country, and then to leave a skill if and when they go? Because exodus seems to be more from South Africa. Yes, there's exodus throughout the world, but South Africa seems to be taking a ban on that. And I think it's good you are revitalizing. But in your right sizing, are there any units that you've got rid of or deprived of reduced researchers on, namely those that you were funding on traditional medicine? I know DST is also funding that. And finally, do you communicate with, I'm sure you do communicate, but maybe if you've got a moment to give us if you do communicate with your research brothers and sisters, for instance, HSRC does a lot of research, and it also looks into some areas of health. Thank you, Chair.
Ian, we will be meeting the department tomorrow. But I'm sure with Umadlala and Umamshwana, you could comment on certain things if you want to comment. Though we're going to be meeting tomorrow. I don't think one is saying that something drastic has to be done, but all that is being highlighted is that we think that the MRC is one of the research and the evidence. It's very important for us to make policies. That's what we're saying. Maybe the question, I don't know whether it's going to be easy, neither do I know whether, I was thinking about it to ask you, but you might not answer it if you don't want to. South Africa is one of strong economies in Africa. And you see there's a lot of people who want to come to South Africa from within Africa. And some of the countries, what they do, they take the brains from other countries who want to come to their countries, and they make them their citizens, and they improve their own countries. I'm not saying it's not happening in South Africa. Is this something that where you see somebody who's brilliant, you think of making that person? It might not be your question. It might not be your question. Because the interest is making South Africa a better country, to be recognized with that. So now why, and if you happen to have that opportunity of people wanting to come to it, not everybody, you don't want to open gates, but those who can improve the situation, do you ever consider saying, hey, this one is brilliant, he can make an impact in South Africa? It's not a liability, it's an asset. He or she is an asset. You think of saying, oh, this side, this is good, let me bring him to South Africa. And I mean, probably it's not for you to answer, but I know other countries, they do that. They do that quite a lot. When people get interested in them, but let's allow you to answer questions. NHLS, we apologize. We're going to delay a little bit because we started late, but we are with you. Okay.
Thank you very much. So why don't I...
Yeah. I'll ask the chair of our auditors committee to address the question that I'll bring up.
I wanted to ask about my case because I'm not supposed to do that. So I wanted to receive some treatment, but we'll talk about it outside. You don't have to answer that
question. I can answer it. It's you and Hugh Masekela. I have a relationship with Hugh Masekela because his cult also don't produce milk. And it's because he's a bad father. Listen, maybe you're a good medical doctor and a bad farmer. No, it's just a partial comment on that first issue of the funding. And if you look on your slide 18, I think that the fact that the overall budget has increased by 31% is something quite remarkable and is very important for the MRC to begin to play the role it should be playing. It doesn't detract from the comments that the President made about sufficient funding. Some of that funding is earmarked and doesn't necessarily address the immediate challenge we have of a 40 million rand deficit in relation to day-to-day operational funding, because the earmarked funding must be used for the purpose for which it has been granted. But in the 10-point plan of the Department of Health, the 10th point, which is not necessarily because it's the least important point, as the Minister has pointed out from time to time, is funding of research. And I think that in terms of your committee, the issue is how do we increase that envelope in order to make as big an impact as the MRC has the potential to make, because it is sufficiently funded. And sufficient is as long as a piece of string. So I think that the President has really had remarkable success in mobilizing funds from other sources, because I don't think there would be any entity anywhere else that can say, on the bottom line, we've got a 31% increase. Plus has the ability to ensure that that 31% increase is significantly changing and repositioning medical research in our country to ensure that health systems and our provision of services in health is improved. So I think the issue is about how do we make sure that we optimally use the current envelope with the successes, but don't underestimate the fact that a lot of that new funding is earmarked, and therefore we still do have a challenge. But I just wanted to comment on that first issue of sufficient funding, because I think that we must balance the issue of sufficient with the remarkable achievement that should be in the headlines of the reporting from this committee, that in fact there has been a significant change in the way, in the positioning of medical research under the tenure of the new president. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Dr. Hanekom. So I'll deal with the issues very quickly because I know time is running by, and I'll start backwards and work my way up. So I want to just perhaps start by making an observation that might be quite obvious, in that medical research is a global endeavor, and the great minds that work on medical research are everywhere. So the way we try to work in this global community is through a very complex approach of competition and collaboration. We compete against each other. That is fundamental. That's what leads to the greatness of the science. We compete, each one trying to do better than the other. But we also collaborate. So it is quite a strange thing because I'll compete against my colleagues on WITS, but on another project I'll be collaborating with them and we'll be working as the best friends and partners. It is in the nature of science to do that. So often we don't try to steal people from elsewhere. Or rather what we do is collaborate with them. Many of them have their strengths in where they are. They have a unique situation. They have access to unique patients. They have access to unique specimens. But that we would have unique equipment and so on, so that they'll send us students. So we have students coming from all over the world. I mean, as we speak, I have a whole bunch of students from China. I have students from Ethiopia, from Saudi Arabia. They're coming here to come and learn on certain technologies that we are very far advanced. And I think it, just in the same way I send my students to go to the NIH's Vaccine Research Center or to go to Duke University. I have two students right now at Harvard learning new techniques, learning on a new approach to separating cells. We just bought a Fax Aria. That's a 12 million rand piece of equipment. Without that Fax Aria, I can't do what I need to do. But that machine separates individual cells for me. And I can take each cell and look at what antibodies it can produce. So this machine is incredible. And we can't use it unless we have people trained to be able to do that. So they trained at Harvard, and now there are a whole group of people doing PhDs and so on this. So it's in the nature of research that it's a global enterprise and that we work with each other. We don't hassle when scientists leave to go and work in another lab. We'll just collaborate with them there. You know, that's just how it is. It's just part of the brain. We don't take that too much of an issue. And brain drain in research is routine. Researchers are highly mobile because they have unique skills and they can generate money and they have ideas. And it's a commodity in scarce supply, so they can get jobs anywhere. Yeah, as the chair said, you know, they can just walk because they are very sellable people. So I think that I wanted to just clarify that, and that's the approach we take. I have to tell you that in truth, that if you look at medical education in this country, most of the registrars, not most, I stand to be corrected, I would say a sizable number of registrars are now registrars from all over Africa. We are training registrars from the DRC, from Zimbabwe, from Zambia, and so on. And we have to, for them to have a cardiothoracic surgeon, that person is either going to go and train in England, how they used to do it before, or they'll come here. So they might as well come here where they'll train under us. So it is routine. And so those people are the ones we also want to get involved in research. So we include them in research. It's part and parcel of how we work. Let me go to your points very quickly then. So I've addressed the issue around the brain drain and how we deal with that in its broadest context. I'll deal with communication with other science councils. So we have both informal mechanisms. You know, Olive and I have a routine tea that we have, especially when I'm coming here because our office is just across the road. And we meet with the CSR on a regular basis. Rachel Chikwamba and I meet all the time. And the idea is that we have our formal meetings where we all meet together as cohort, which is the council of the heads of science institutions. And we also meet informally so that we can really try and push the envelope because we don't want to duplicate. I mean, what the HSRC does is quite a lot of medical research. And we don't have a problem with that. That's fine. We just want to make sure we're not duplicating it and that we're collaborating as much as possible. The same with the CSR. I mean, it's become very clear to us that CSIR has unique skills that we just, it'll take us forever to build it. Why are we trying to build it when they have it? I mean, for example, they have an amazing high throughput facility for traditional medicine. Why should we try to set that up? I mean, we made an attempt, which is really a pathetic attempt, and it's proven not to be very successful. So what are we doing now? We're working with the CSIR. We'd rather just work with them. It makes much more sense. So we're all funded by the same pot eventually. And so we're learning that those kinds of collaboration between us as science councils also gives us greater strength. In terms of the intramural program and whether we've reduced our structures as part of the revitalization, yes, we have. Part of this is to focus the organization. We've had this period of unchecked growth. We now have to have a period of consolidation. So what we've done is we said, okay, we've got too many TB researchers, too much disparity. So what we're going to do is we're going to consolidate it. We're going to have one TB unit, we're going to do this, and this is where it's going to be based. So as part of that process, we've had to look at those units that we want to close. And that's what we've negotiated with the trade unions. We are, you know, this is South Africa. We have to work with trade unions. We have just over 60% of our staff are unionized. And so that is just part of the reality of what we deal with. We don't have a problem with that. That's their right. In fact, it helps us because it gives us a collective voice to work with. But it is a challenge in that we have to find each other. And that's not always obvious. You know, we've been trying to find each other on many issues. And I'm pleased to say we find each other more often now. And it's been a steady improvement in our relationship. So this agreement we have on the 1st of March is unprecedented. I mean, we all agree that we will reduce our intramural program from 27 units to 13 units. We all agree that we will consolidate these. We all agree on what we will do and how we will reorganize the structure. So we have broad agreement. And it's in that spirit I think we can move forward. And I'm very pleased to say that we are now able to move forward in that. As far as the Department of Higher Education contribution, the way we fund medical research is we work on the basis that the Department of Higher Education funds the salaries. So that the medical school staff, actually their salaries are already covered. So in many ways, the Department of Higher Education is contributing to medical research. They just don't know it. The Department of Higher Education has also a separate fund, which is a research fund, which they give to all universities based on productivity. So each university has to lodge the number of papers. They call it SAPSI units. Based on your SAPSI units, you get a grant from the Department of Higher Education. That SAPSI unit money, the grant that you get, is used by most universities to fund the next set of medical research, the next set of research. It covers all research, not only medical. But I can tell you, for example, in UCT Wits that I'm familiar with, Madunsa, that money is key to being the base that they use. So that's what they use to renovate laboratories, to make sure we employ technicians. That's sort of core costs. So that when they come to the MRC, what they're looking for is money to pay for patients to participate in, or for some reagents or to buy some new piece of equipment that adds on to something else. So I have to say that it takes many players to make research happen in this country. Higher education, DST, NRF, ourselves, we all contribute. Sometimes it might look like a circus, but like all good circuses, it's well organized. Everybody knows their place, and they know when to come in and how they contribute. As far as TB is concerned, there is no question. South Africa is one of the world's epicenters for TB. We have the third largest number of TB patients, and that shouldn't lead us to think anything about the other two, because the other two are India and Indonesia, which have much bigger populations. As incidence of TB, we are the highest in the world. And it's not for any other reason than we have the preconditions for TB. And the HIV epidemic is just one of the major contributors that leads to the high incidence of TB. The others are mines, as you know, asbestos and the mining community, TB is a huge problem there. The other is the background problems that we have of alcohol. Alcohol is a major contributor to TB. And our growing prevalence of diabetes, which is a major contributor to TB as well. So we've got a confluence of many factors that is pushing up our TB problem. And fundamentally, TB is a treatable condition. I mean, there should be no reason why we can't deal with TB. It's a, not a treatable, it's a curable condition. We have singularly failed to do that effectively. And that failure has is manifested in many different ways. But fundamentally, we have not been able to achieve 85% cure rate. If we can achieve 85% cure rate, and that's all based on all the models done by WHO, we can control TB in this country. But we haven't been able to do that because we can't get patients to take their medication for 6 months. I mean, we can't get 85%, you know, of the patients to just take their medication. And we have to look at how we can do better. We've gone to fixed dose combinations, we've gone to DOT, where we've had directly observed treatment, we've had a whole range of strategies. We've got to do better. But to me, I think ultimately it's going to be either that we have short-term therapy, where you take your TB treatment is 1 week course and you're done, or it's a vaccine. And so we put energies in both regards. Remember, our problem with TB is not just that we can't treat it. We can't diagnose it. You know, in about a third of the patients, we're dealing with smear-negative TB that we just can't diagnose. And even with latest technologies like GeneXpert, you still have the huge problem of possibility TB or extrapulmonary TB that you can't diagnose. In children, it's even worse. I mean, to try and diagnose TB in children, I mean, you know what a challenge that is. So we do have lots of problems in TB. And what we're seeing is this inexorable shift from, you know, sensitive TB to resistant TB to multi-drug resistant to extremely drug resistant, and now, as you heard, we've had the first few cases of totally drug resistant TB, where there's nothing that works. So we, as a country, we've got to take on this challenge, really. And I can tell you within the MRC, we have huge programs underway. And if you take, you know, in TB, there's only been one drug that's come onto the market in the last, 30 years for TB. And we're very pleased to say that the MRC was part and parcel of developing that drug. So when you look at the New England Journal of Medicine paper on bediquilin, the MRC features as one of the partners involved in developing it. As you know, or you may be aware, bediquilin has just been approved by WHO as part of the TB regimen, so it's likely going to be incorporated into new guidelines. But it's the first drug for TB in 40 years. So you know, we're going to have to do better. We're going to have to find many, many more new drugs, and that's what SHIP is about. So it gives me a good entree into SHIP. SHIP stands for Strategic Health Innovation Partnerships. It's to develop drugs. It's to develop vaccines. It's to develop diagnostics. If you take the big discovery we made last year about two KwaZulu-Natal women, who developed a very broadly neutralizing antibody against HIV. And we discovered how these women were able to make this. I mean, that has changed the face of HIV. But that discovery, published in Nature Medicine, cost us something like 200 million rand over the last 11 years. That's the investment made to make those kinds of discoveries. So when that paper was published, when that discovery was made, you know, we got a call straight away from the Gates Foundation. How do we make this now? You know, can we make this into a passive immunity strategy? And when Bill Gates was visiting in December last year, he flew us down, two of us, to come and meet with him. He met with us for 2 hours. And his question to us is, okay, what is it going to take to make this now? Can you make this antibody that you discovered? Can we make it? You know, what is it going to take? So we had to keep explaining to him, this is knowledge. Not a product. We discovered knowledge. So he has now put a whole team onto this to try and make those antibodies in the lab, and then we can inject people with these antibodies. To do that, you need partnerships. We need partnerships with Gates. We need with industry. We need with academics. We need with international funding organizations. That's what SHIP is. SHIP is about bringing those players together. We're talking about moving a new malaria drug through its clinical phases. We estimate that investment will cost around 300 to 400 million rand. SHIP will have to contribute, you know, at least 10-15% of that. We're going to have to get the rest from big donors. So that's what it's going to take to develop a new drug. That's what it costs. That's what it takes to do it. We have to do it because we have to find the solutions. If we don't find the solutions for TB, we don't find the solutions for HIV, nobody else is going to do that on our behalf. It's our job. We've got to do it. And then we've taken that attitude in SHIP and other. So we're developing new diagnostics, and that's what SHIP is about. Just very quickly, I want to deal now with the issue of violence and rape. We have two internal programs that look at violence and rape. We have an injury and violence research program, which looks at basically not just motor vehicle accidents, but all kinds of trauma. And then we have a special gender unit. So if you look at when the whole Pistorius case came into the forefront and Anel Boyson issue came to the forefront, the MRC was being quoted, you know, between 70 to 100 times a day. And we get these hits of all of the quotations. And our data is the only data there is. I mean, if you want to know about rape in this country, you have to look at our data. We're the only ones that produce it. So our data on looking and trying to understand rape, I have to tell you, is complicated. I mean, you know, I study HIV, and this is a very difficult virus. But the human mind, and particularly the male mind, is even more complicated. And how, what leads to rape is a very complex issue. I won't bore you with that. But we have huge programs underway to understand that. And I have to tell you that rape is not simply a psychological problem. It's also a policing problem. It's also a masculinity problem. It's a, there's many, many sides to this problem. And if there's a belief that you can just get away with rape, that's what people will do, because they feel they can get away with it. So we have to deal with it in all these layers, and that's what our program is looking at it in all its different facets. On child mortality, I am very pleased to say, I mean, as you know, we wrote the Lancet series, and the Minister of Health launched the Lancet series in 2009, one of the first things he did when he became minister, where we pointed how badly our country was doing. We were going in the wrong direction on most of the health NDGs. We've now just, as you know, in October last year, published the update. So what has happened since 2009? When we wrote the last Lancet series, we wrote the new Lancet series. And the Lancet articles are definitely worth looking at because they are packed with data. Everything we say, there's scientific evidence that backs it up. And this Lancet article is just a good news story because we are doing so well on so many things. And it was really pleased to be, we were really pleased to be able to say that. Because it makes us proud to be South African, to be able to say we're making these achievements. But I have to say that the one area I feel particularly dejected, because we are still going in the wrong direction, is maternal mortality. Our maternal mortality continues. It is proving to be recalcitrant. And despite every attempt being made, I'm not sure what next, but we have a program of research now trying to understand why our maternal mortality is going up. And HIV is part and parcel of this problem. And maybe this new attempt to shift to option B and option B plus may be the solution to this problem. I think we're left to be seen. And that's part of the data we will have to generate. But I think that we cannot say we've won or that we've achieved what we wanted to until we can start saving mothers' lives. That any woman should die giving birth is just unacceptable. And I think we want to continue that fight. I want to just end off with just making one or two last comments. On the policy briefs, I think we just have to accept it's not a very good vehicle. It was a good idea, but one in practice that doesn't really work all that well. We have to look for an alternative. Whether the alternative is a short video or something else, we have to figure out how do we communicate more effectively. And so that's part and parcel of what we're trying to do. We're trying to find better ways of communicating our message. And it's pleasing to see that, you know, our messages are getting through at some level. At least it's getting into the State of Nation address. It's now, I mean, there's not a day that goes by without the MRC being in the news. I mean, we are in the news every day. Whether it's on the Pistorius case, or whether it's our data on salt intake, or our new data on exercise. I mean, we are in the news. We are part and parcel of informing South Africa's debates on health, and that's what I'm very pleased to say that's what we should be doing. And we spend very little on consultants. So this is a question that was raised in Parliament to the Minister, so we got asked to answer it. We have very few consultants. I would imagine, I think the answer we had was we spend less than 1% of our budget on. So we're not really, the kinds of people we need institutional memory. So consultants really come for managerial things and short-term things. Most of the people actually run the organization. They're there. And MRC is a long-standing institution in that respect. I'll end off with the issue of money, and just to say that I do believe that South Africa is indeed a country of many talents and great skills in medical research. I advise the Chinese government. I've been to the Indian government's AIDS research program. I've been to Fiocruz in Brazil. So, I mean, I'm part of all the BRICS activities. And I've seen our capabilities. We have great minds that would compete comfortably with anything I've seen in the other BRIC countries. The level of research we do, especially in HIV and TB, is unparalleled. None of our other BRIC partners can even compete against us. But where we fall down is in technology. There, the Indians, the Chinese, they are just too good. They are masters of taking knowledge and converting it into new technologies, new drugs, new gadgets. I mean, they just copy. They don't even innovate. They just take something and copy it, and they reverse engineer it, and they have huge factories just churning the stuff out. We haven't learned that. And I think that's part and parcel of what we're going to have to learn. If we want to be with the BRICS countries, we're going to have to learn to walk among giants of that nature. We're going to have to learn the language, we're going to have to learn those skills, and we're going to have to learn where we're strong and where we're weak. And the MRC is very much part and parcel of our strength. Thank you.
Thank you very much. I don't think we'll entertain any more questions, but okay, I'll allow you.
I don't think I heard an answer, and perhaps it was when I was eating. But did you tell us anything about any research on the NHI?
Oh,
because I think that's quite a vital issue.
I stopped the last one before. My apologies.
Yeah.
My apologies. So one of the 13 units that we are restructuring the MRC into is a unit specifically on the NHI. So we've opened a discussion with the Department of Health, and in my last meeting with the Deputy Minister, we've raised this issue. We don't want to do research on the NHI unless we do it with the Department of Health, because otherwise it's already a busy terrain. We'll just be duplicating what others are doing. So what we've put on the table is our strength. Our strength would be to go to the 10 pilot districts and to do a baseline measure of all of the disease patterns. So we can tell you, after the pilot NHI implementation over 5 years, what have we improved and what haven't we improved. If we don't do that, then I think we would not know where we are succeeding and where we are not. So our niche in the NHI debate and the research terrain has been to focus more on the health profile. We really didn't want to get involved in the financing side. There are already three different groups working on that. And as far as the actual organizational aspects, they are just so fluid. So I think what we want to do is we want to be supportive to the government's efforts. And I think we all agree, and it's part of our plan and part of our policy, that you know, the NHI is here, and it's going to be the best way we can move forward right now. How we make it happen is what's going to define its success. Not that it itself is not going to be a success, but how we implement it. So we are very much part and parcel, and you'll see it's one of the units we have.
Okay, without getting an answer, maybe we could just ask that on that point around technology, if there is anything that we as a committee should be able to do in terms of, I don't know, relating to science and technology, whatever, anything that perhaps should be being done differently that we could be useful in kind of
Okay, you want to respond to that?
No, I think it's an open question. I mean, I think it's a question we all will be trying to grapple with.
Okay, thank you. I think Bill gave it just because of time. We will call it a day. We won't even have tea, but we'll have 5 minutes to allow any tellers to prepare for that. But thank you very much for the presentation. And we are definitely going to find a way. I'm not sure. I mean, you've made a very important comment there. That we've got the brain, but we don't have the technology. Maybe this is where we need to sit down and say, how do we get the technology so that we could be one of the best and we could compete quite well with others. And so it's a very important point. It's a very important one. Members, let's leave it at that and let's prepare for anything.